Hello and welcome to The Review, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24, with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Steve Bloomfield.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll hear what's been dominating the window displays in bookshops in Milan, San Francisco and Nairobi.
We sell a few school books and children books, a little bit, but we are more of politic books and motivational books.
And we'll also be listening to some new music from Stephen Bass, owner of the Mushy Mushy label.
And we'll be flicking through a stack of our favourite magazines with Mark Valley, owner of Magma Books and editor of Elephant Magazine.
All that and much more right here in The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé and Steve Bloomfield on this very, very sunny Saturday. Every time we do The Review, every time I'm in London, it's always gorgeous beyond these walls.
Spring has started.
Yeah.
And yes, and here we are in Studio One.
Exactly. And as you said, we cracked open the door on the editorial floor for the very first time today. It's very nice.
It was, yeah, for the first time in probably about 4 or 5 months.
That's quite exciting because we've been expanding at such a rate that as soon as you open the doors, it means we can probably get at least another 10 or 15 new interns working on the terrace all summer, which is great.
Yeah, I don't think they'll mind that as well. apart from those days where it's perhaps not quite as warm and lovely as today.
Exactly. We're going to, do a little bit of a tour of global bookshops. But before that, anything else? Well, I was going to say anything to catch your eye on the papers. There are no newspapers in here. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Me and Andrew Moller did them all last night. You were having a very good time with Hugo McDonald.
I was. Yeah, it was Hugo McDonald at Zionist. It was his 30th birthday.
Yes.
So we went for a few drinks.
Does he sound older than 30 when he's on air? I'm wondering.
I don't know. I think he sounds. He used to sound like he was 29, but when he was on yesterday, he did sound like he was 30. So I'm afraid we didn't hear the Monocle Daily last night.
The only thing I have here, which is one of my favorite magazines. This is a very interesting instance where I've moved. I mean, I think most of my trade reading I've moved online, and now I've actually gone back to Flight International because the Flight Global website, they redesigned it, and it's just one of those fatal steps that you redesign a site and it's so cumbersome. It is interesting actually, print versus digital, because it's actually quite easy to go and change a magazine again, but to go and rebuild an entire website is a complete nightmare. So I've actually gone back to reading Flight International every week, as opposed to reading it sort of daily and obsessively online.
Is it better just having it in your hand and flicking through it?
It is, but actually the daily website was really good, but what they decided is they created like 50 subcategories, as opposed to having sort of a rolling news feed where if you wanted to read about airlines or defense or whatever, you know, you could just like scroll down. But now you had to go sort of, you know, sector by sector. It was like, okay, propellers, you know, four engine aircraft, etc. So anyways,
don't feel like clicking on propellers every morning?
No, I don't.
No.
But what's also interesting is there's the cover stories about the big Singapore air show and our Gabriel Lee and Gillian Dubois. We just put up a great film. So if anyone wants to know what's happening in the world of, not just aviation in Southeast Asia, but also what it means, I think, geopolitically as well, have a peek at that film.
Indeed.
Should we do bookstores and something less toothsome, maybe, though?
Yes, let's do bookstores. You're listening to Review on Monocle 24. We're going to be talking books right after this. So we start today, as ever, with a global check-in on a trio of independent bookshores. Some, I think they could be
I
called
like
bookshores.
That. Yeah, absolutely.
To hear what's selling.
And we start with the bookshop Hopli in Milano.
I am Andrea Milke, and I'm working in a Hopli bookshop here in Milan. It's a quite famous bookshop. We have 6 floors with only books. And we are also a publishing house, and I take care of the fiction section, and I would like to tell you just some titles that we sell very well at the moment. Today is a quite important day because it's coming out a very important book of Carlos Ruiz Zafón. He's a Spanish author, and it's the new title, El Prisionero del Cielo, and yes, all the people are waiting for the book, so today is the day. There are many good writers at the moment, like there's Marco Malvaldi. He wrote this book La Carta Più Alta. It's like a crime story, and the publisher house Celerio, it's a little publisher of Sicily, yes, and he wrote a lot of books, and the people are like him, and so there, I think that they read a lot of Italian but also a lot of strangers. In 6 floors, you have a lot of space for other books. So we have a very important art section and a design section, books of architecture and economics section. So the non-fiction books, at the moment, there's a very important book of Marco Travaglio. He wrote about the 20th anniversary. It comes out last week, and yeah, we have it also in the window because it's quite important. Right now, also very good and important book is the new book of Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. He is the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, and yes, it's also in the window. Another very important argument last year was Steve Jobs. And last but not least, I would like to tell you one of my favorite books that I read in the last years. The author is Roman Gary, it's a French author, and the Italian title is La Vita davanti a sé. And it's like a French Giovane Holden, you know, the book of Salinger, Catcher in the Rye, and it's a French version. I mean, it's a fantastic story. You must read it.
And that was the Hopley Bookshop in Milan. I could listen to her all day. Yeah. Steve Jobs.
It was quite jazzy as well.
I liked it. It was good.
It worked well. Well, next up, we're going to head to my old home, Nairobi, to visit the Prestige Bookshop.
I'm called Ahmed Mohsin Ali. I'm the manager of Prestige Bookshop. We are located on Mamangina Street, near 20th Century in Nairobi, Kenya. We are the oldest bookshop in town. We mostly sell post-academic books. We are famous for our politic books and motivational. We sell African books a lot, mostly on politics. Yeah, but we are all round. We sell a few school books and children books a little bit. But we are more of politic books and motivational books. Yeah. The books that I've been selling for the last week is one of the biggest books is Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. We know what Steve Jobs has done, and I think people are interested to know who he was and how Apple has changed the world. The other one is by Mandela, Conversation with Myself. People still want to know the intimate part of Mandela with himself. Yeah, and Wangari Maathai, and there's the other one of Lin Kuan Yew, From Third World to First. I think it's an amazing book. A lot of Africans want to know how Singapore made it to where it is, especially Kenya. People are very interested to know how they can get out of this state. I'm expecting a new book about Somalia, What Went Wrong with Somalia by Mary Harper, and the other one maybe the Obamas, the book that is mostly talking about the family of Obama in the White House. I expect something from the local scene, maybe Hope and Despair, that was done last year by Daniel. Usually these days people are interested in the local politics. We have almost everything. We have a lot of classics, more motivational biographies, also things that are talking about Sudan, people, and Somalia. People want to know what is going on about those countries, especially Somalia. I think these people are having more interest in the international sector. Like From Tyranny to Anarchy, how Somalia has gone down the drain from its 20 years of civil war. The other one may be of Sudan, called A New Sudan in the Making by Francis Deng. It's actually talking about or what challenges and anticipations South Sudan is going to anticipate.
And that was Prestige Bookshop in Nairobi.
Do you know it well?
I do, yeah. They've got a couple of branches there, and as he says, they are the oldest in Nairobi. Their problem is that, as he says, they sell a lot of textbooks.
And so you don't really know if it's sort of an academic
setup. Well, there's those are things that sell. And it's a real problem for writers in East Africa as well. That you know, there's these amazing writers who've written some fantastic novels that they've sent off to publishers. Mm. And publishers just stick them on a dusty shelf and never get around to reading them because the money is all in textbooks.
And having never been to Nairobi, I have this romantic notion that there's some wonderful sort of, you know, dusty bookshop that's run by some old colonel who's been there forever. Does that exist?
There is. My favourite one was actually run by an old Indian Kenyan guy who always had all the sort of anti-government books when Kenya was a dictatorship, and he'd always sell them in brown paper bags from underneath the desk. But he got in a lot of trouble and was sued a couple of times. But the building that he was in was owned by a government minister. And because the bookshop was so popular, the government minister was quite happy for him to be there, despite the fact he was selling a lot of anti-government literature.
And is he still around?
Yeah, he's still around. Yeah. No, he's still doing well.
And I guess there's been no plague of any. I mean, a little while ago, we looked at some bookshops in Cairo, and there was, like, you know, the makings of a small chain. But you don't see any sort of big players with multiple branches in.
Well, Prestige has two or three branches, I think. But no, there's no.
No superstores sort of in the suburbs surrounding.
No, not quite. I mean, there's a couple of big shopping centres that do sort of music and DVDs and then some books as well.
Right.
So they're starting to get there. It was interesting what he was saying. You know, he mentioned the Steve Jobs book as well. You know, so from and obviously I'm sure in San Francisco, the next one coming up, I'm sure it'll be popular there as well. But it's interesting that that's been so popular,
yes,
all over the world.
A very happy Mr. Walter Isaacson. We are going to go to San Francisco indeed right now and check in with the booksmith.
My name is Kristen Evans and I own the Booksmith. The Booksmith is located in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury, which is a historic neighborhood that dates from the 1900s, but really is known from its history in the 1960s, when hippies and love children came from around the country to congregate and try to create a new world, a new utopian view of society. So we had free stores on the street, we had people living in collectives and communes, and today we still have the remnants of the Summer of Love in the form of artistic creatives who are now working in Silicon Valley's tech startups. And we have people that are artists and graphic designers that embrace all the things outside the mainstream. The bookstore's been in the neighborhood since 1976 and in this location since 1985. When my husband and I purchased the store from the founder in 2007, one of the things that we did as a remodel of the space. It was always a very welcoming store to the community, but we realized in the age of the digital, the ebook and e-commerce, you needed to have a space that was really beautiful and welcoming. And so we start right at the beginning in the front of the store by opening up the windows, and we started doing just really interesting and creative displays. One of the longtime staff members of the Booksmith is Sean Cheeky, and he does all of this beautiful artwork here above the sections. He also does our window design, so he's always coming up with creative, fun things. Right now we have a Wheel of Fortune in the window that has a Cupid and love and lust in a wheel that's spinning for Valentine's Day. What's selling really well right now is the Biorite Markets Eat Good Food, which is part cookbook, part shopping guide on how to shop from your local sustainable grocer. Another book that's selling really well is The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson. It's a novel set in North Korea, and it's dark but also has a romance, and it's epic in its narrative storytelling. But there are so few books written about North Korea, and the author did a really amazing job of unlocking a lot of secrets of that part of the world that we don't know a lot about. A new release we're really excited about is A Theory of Small Earthquakes by Meredith Marin. It is, as she puts it, lovable gay characters. Like in the spirit of Armistead Maupin, she's really taken the story of the American family that has challenges and then seeks redemption in the end. We have a lot of fun things in the window. One of my favorite books that just came out is from a local author, Daniel Handler. He's maybe a little bit better known as Lemony Snicket. So he has a YA novel that's illustrated here by Myra Kallman, who is the really fun and quirky comic illustrator. So it's a young woman in high school, and she's just broken up with her boyfriend, and she's writing him a really long letter documenting their relationship. And Myra illustrates all of the archival material that she's collected throughout their relationship.
That was Booksmith in San Francisco. And she didn't mention Steve Jobs.
No, she didn't.
She didn't good after all that.
I was suddenly wondering what those sounds were in between every little clip. Was that the sound of the till opening and closing?
Well, I thought it might be the door as well.
Oh, it could have been the door as well. Okay, that's the beauty of audio. Just use your imagination.
Exactly.
We're going to get a little musical after our break. We're going to be talking to Stephen Bass, owner of Mushy Mushy Music, right here on The Review on Monocle 24.
The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced current affairs hour at midday London time. We review the American front pages, fresh off the press, check in on the stories unfolding in Europe, and round up the events at the end of the day in Asia.
This extraordinary thing which traverses seven time zones and arrives absolutely on the minute, 8 days after you left Moscow Station.
From Buenos Aires to Boston, wake up with The Briefing, live every weekday at midday London time, 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design hour. It's a show about the things that we live with. Join us as we take you on a tour of the finest furniture, buildings and fashion from around the world. From ramshackle warehouses to luxury runways, hard hat construction sites to the safety of the studio, we bring you the people and products that fill our lives.
These people find a common ground, and you know if they do that you're probably onto something that everybody in the world might be able to agree with.
Tune in each week to hear about the things that make life better. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, and Steve Bloomfield.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're joined in the studio by the owner of Mushy Mushy label, Stephen Bass. Welcome, Stephen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the label?
It's been going for 14 years, I believe, now. It's an independent label owned by myself and my partner and friend, Michael. And we started up when we were both working at major record labels and just wanted to do our own thing. I think how a lot of these started up. And, a traditional bedroom record label, though, I always had ambitions to have it be something more than that.
To break out of the bedroom.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's very much a work in progress, I think, personally, anyway. I often sort of wish we were better and strive to be better and strive to find better music and just be function better, really, because I think it's a big responsibility taking on musicians' work and, and it is a business, but it's very much a business that's born of our own love of music and trying to make that bit where art and commerce meet works in a fun way, you know. So we just work with music we love and try and develop careers for the artists and for ourselves.
And give us an idea of the music you love and the artists that you love that you've got signed to your label.
Currently we work with a band called Slow Club, The Wave Pictures, Casio Kids. We've just signed a band called Fiction. We also work with The Very Best, Hercules and Love Affair. We're trying to sign a few more. In the past, we released the first Hot Chip album, which is perhaps a sort of a key album in Mushy Mushy's history, really. I think they represent the sort of band that we love, and I certainly personally really like sort of experimental, exciting music made by creative people, but still at its heart is quite poppy and giving, I think, you know. We've released a lot of first releases by artists that have gone on to be bigger, Florence and the Machine, Licky Lee, people like this in the past, which has been good for us, but it's not the aim, you know. We aim to keep things and develop.
What's the state of independence in London and maybe all over Europe right now versus, you know, the big labels? And of course, you know, the big labels have, you know, a number of boutique spin-offs, but you know, when you look at the FT or any of the major, you know, financial dailies, you just see, you know, tales of woe with the majors. Are you in a more sort of nimble position, and in a way, do you have, you know, scope to maybe weather this better than the bigger boys?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about it, obviously, especially with Adele cleaning up so much recently. I think it's the modern world. It's enabled us to do a lot of things from wherever we are around the world, definitely. And I think it's been a really turbulent time, but I'm getting a sense that perhaps the world is just settling down slightly. You know, we've had the internet for 15 years, is it? Perhaps 10, 15 years. Everyone, you know, obviously everything's turned on its head. Everyone's been running around going bonkers, but it feels like people are sort of slowly settling down. And it could be that, you know, it's going to help us, I think. I think that music tastes are slightly changing, or people are actually getting back a little bit to taking a little time to listen to music. And I think if independent is in a better place to work like this, you know, I'm very much obsessed these days of artist development and career artists and artists that perhaps don't break until their third record. And this is an area that traditionally independents excel in and labor's major struggle in, because the way they're set up is that they need big winners to keep them going. I mean, it's still very, very tough, and anyone who runs a record independent record label, as I'm sure many sort of independent creative concerns, you know, you have to work so hard. You know, you have to try and do everything to broaden your reach and to survive.
Tell us about it.
But so it's definitely tough, and the majors in some ways have things a lot easier because they have finances, and finance is always a struggle. But I do think it's turning a corner.
You've lined up a couple of songs for us. Maybe tell us a little bit about Mickey Moonlight.
Mickey Moonlight is signed to a label called Ed Banger Records, which is an independent, which also works with Because Music, which is a big French label, which I think is distributed by Warner's. So, but he's an English guy who's been around, I think, for quite a while. He's friends with a lot of great musicians, and it's the first time I think it's his first album, but it got sent to me recently, and I put it on last weekend. I was driving to Norwich, of all places, to see Metronomy, who we manage, play at the NME show, and I think it's a beautiful album. And I think it's very free and free-spirited, and reminds me a lot of great things, among them Sesame Street and Funkadelic, and all sort of in a quite a nice at-home, easy listening in your living room, house music-oriented vibe.
Let's have a listen to Come On Humans by Mickey Moonlight. That was Come On Humans by Mickey Moonlight here on The Review on Monocle 24. We're chatting to Stephen Bass, owner and founder of Mushy Mushy record label, or co-founder, in fact, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Steve, you were sort of jumping at the bit earlier. You almost fell off the table, I noticed.
Chomping at the bit.
Yeah.
I know. What I find interesting, and Stephen, you brought in some of the albums at the Wave Pictures, which I think we're going to hear in a bit, and also Slow Club Paradise and a couple of others. The artwork on the CDs, there's clearly been a lot of thought put into it. And I'm just intrigued as to sort of, now that so much is online and so many people are downloading their songs and albums, how important is the artwork on the cover of a CD or an LP compared to how it was 20, 30 years ago?
I still hold it really important myself. I mean, I come from that period personally, but I think you still have to stand out. Whether even if you're on iTunes, you have to stand out. And we always get the bands to design their own artwork as well. I just think it's much purer. It just comes from them, you know. It's much more an expression of what they are, and you know, it's all communication. I think the more of the artist's character and creativity you can present to the audience, the better. Doesn't always work out so well. Sometimes there aren't, isn't quite as good, annoyingly.
And I have to ask about the name of the label. You know, Mushy Mushy. That was sort of just a cynical bit of branding that you're hoping that the major labels from Japan would just call up saying, yes, you know what, we'll buy a million of them.
No, totally not. We'd spent ages trying to think of a name, as you do. I bet you know. And it just wasn't happening. And then there was an old magazine called Jockey Slut from, I don't know, 15 years ago, which I used to absolutely adore. And they had an article in there about a couple of Japanese kids who were in London with a battery-operated record deck DJing in the streets, and I wanted to speak to them.
Right.
And so I got a number somehow and called them up and...
Mosh mosh.
Well, it was not that. They couldn't understand a word, so a friend of mine spoke Japanese and I asked him what to say, and that's when I first... He said, say moshi moshi, and I was like, well, that'll do. You know, it sort of doesn't say anything, but it sort of has a good ring to it, and so that's where that came from.
When you're mentioning also some of the international artists that you're working with, is London still, you know, a hub, even if you are, you know, in, you know, even if you're in Berlin or Oslo, that this is, you know, still a place which is breaking talent? Or do you also feel within Europe that there's sort of competition from other hotbeds of music right now?
London's still very much the place, I think, and Britain as well. You know, it's got a certain size, a certain geography, a certain intent. Amount of people in an area that you can grow things. It's like a sort of petri dish, you know, as opposed to America, things are very expensive. Sweden, obviously, I think, has continued to produce good and interesting musicians, and they're still coming. You know, there's great people all the time. That, I mean, I went to see Little Dragon again last night, who was incredible, sold out the Forum. Lots of interesting people out there. Dan Lisvigge's studio. To me, they're the main areas, but, you know, but Berlin and Germany is always interesting. But London, you know, I think it will always be that in some way. I've heard it said before, there's two sorts of pop music, British and America, you know. And, I mean, if you look at the charts, it still sounds fairly strong.
We're going to listen to The Wave Pictures. They're signed to you, correct?
They're signed to us. This will be their fourth or fifth album we've released. I'm absolutely obsessed with them. I think they're one of the greatest bands around, and you know, they should be way bigger, but I think he's the greatest songwriter. They record in such an old-fashioned, honest way. They took 4 days to record this album. The previous one was 2 days, and the ones before were 1 day. You know, they don't
so muck
around.
So they put a bit more effort in these days, then.
Next time they said they might want to really take a long time and do it in 2 weeks. Okay, but I think they're brilliant.
This is The Wave Pictures with Long Black Cars.
A pirate on a pirate ship throws confetti to the wind. Wasps fly drunkenly into the overflowing bins. A 6 foot yellow bear, a hot air balloon. The whole town came down to see it all this afternoon. Sunlight bounces off the window, blinks into my eye. You promised me you'd give it me, old college try. And the long black cars roll by, the long black cars roll by, and the long black cars roll by me again. You said, David, your brother is coming home, like you always hoped he would. Long down at the mouth, too long up to no good. But I know why you didn't call for so long, and I know why you finally called when you did. Sunlight bounces off the window, blinks into my eye. You promised me you'd give it the old college try. Cars roll by, the long black cars roll by, and the long black cars roll by me again.
That was The Wave Pictures with Long Black Cars, who are signed to the Moshi Moshi label. Stephen Bass, co-founder and owner of Moshi Moshi. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Review on Monocle 24. We're going to be going through a few magazines right after this.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you beautifully shot stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus our regular Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel, food and retail. Premiering this week, novel ideas from Japan.
In the city known to offer the newest and most inventive concepts, Tokyo does it again with Tsutaya Books, a new kind of third space, somewhere that's neither home nor work, and much needed in this dense city.
This and over 250 more films broadcasting on Monocle.com.
The March issue of Monocle marks a very special moment. It's our fifth birthday. In this celebratory issue, we take a close look at how Australia has transformed itself into a resources king and a diplomatic player. By Poland as a new aviation industry high flyer, and we meet a woman still doing very good business in Spain. And there's lots more.
In the design section, we visit a very traditional Swiss furniture manufacturer where old techniques are gathering new business. And we take a tour of Marcio Kogan's latest creation in Sao Paulo.
In the edit section, we head to Tokyo's Hiro District to find out what TV chef Kentaro Kobayashi would order for his last meal.
Plus, there's a 16-page review of Monocle's first 5 years, the perfect place to call home in Boston, and five big ideas to change the world. The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back. It's Saturday, and you're listening to The Review with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tyler Brulé.
And it's my my favourite time of the weekend. I don't want to say it's my favourite programme, but I know that before we get your programme on, your dedicated foreign affairs show, Steve, we're going to spin this segment off into its own sort of one-hour programme. I think we should do it at my office as well, just loads of magazines.
And, that might be quite nice, actually, doing it up there.
Maybe it might be the first live Sunday show. We'll see. Never mind. Anyway, at this point of the program, normally at about 20 minutes to the top of the hour, we always invite a guest to look at their favorite titles. You can actually hear the crinkle of cellophane in the background. That is Mr. Mark Valley. He's the owner of Magma Books, really one of the best outlets for progressive magazines, established titles, and everything else in between here in London. Welcome, Mark. Nice to see you.
Nice to be here, actually.
Now, it's interesting because we were talking about what we were going to kick off with today, and if you've been listening since we launched this program, the amount of people who've come on to the program to talk about Elephant Magazine and have really had it in their stack as one of their picks has been quite extraordinary. And it's your magazine, so tell us a little bit about what was the idea behind Elephant.
Well, the idea behind Elephant was that with Magma, we specialize on visual arts, but not just design, not just art, not just photography. It's visual arts in a broader sense. And we felt there wasn't a magazine out there that really did that. In a way, all magazines do that, because all magazines are very open-minded, and especially the ones we're going to look at today. But no magazine did just that, looking at, what's relevant in terms of visual arts today. And
I was just going to say, though, and on that, I mean, is that looking, because you have the luxury of being a retailer, which is great, so you can sort of look at the till receipts, you can see everything that was coming up.
We cheat a bit.
Of course, exactly, as we all do.
We look behind the scenes. And
how big is Elephant? I've seen it, I picked up in Stockholm, I've seen it in Japan, and obviously, the drive is, not to create a global mammoth, as it were, but it seems that it's definitely getting out there internationally.
Yes, it did grow quite well, and we reached 15,000 copies, which for an art magazine is not a bad figure. We sell at £16, so it's a respectable figure. We now need to go probably the next level, which is to turn into a profitable business, which we haven't quite managed to do yet, but I think we're almost there. And the other thing that is quite hard with an art magazine is to be accepted by the art world. We're still fighting. We still go to art fairs and have to fight for stands with organizers. And the art world is a is a bubble that doesn't like to be burst. It's a very strong thing.
I think
that
can be a lifelong mission.
I mean, do you actually necessarily want to be accepted by the art world, or is there something actually to be said for being seen as a bit of an outsider?
I don't feel quite comfortable with the label outsider. I think it is good to find your place and to be able to talk from a certain, especially in the art world. I think if you're making a statement saying this is a relevant artist, I think you need to, you can't just be an outsider. You need to as well have a way in and be able to get that voice, that choice accepted somehow. So I think for us it is important to little by little gain more acceptance, because it's part of the whole point of doing the magazine, that this point of view will become a bit more accepted. For example, one of the big things that I keep, that I always remind myself when I go to edit an issue is, you see young people today, the young people that come to Magma to buy magazines and the young people that are going to art schools. A lot of them, I'd say about half of them, are really more interested in illustration than they are in painting or installation art or things like that. And yet there is no critical discourse on illustration. Nobody takes it seriously. And it was the same for graphic design 10 years ago. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done there to make art a more interesting, broader place.
But before we jump into looking at some of the titles, I want to pick up on that point about, you know, seeing, you know, let's say a younger demographic coming into your stores, because of course, you know, we always, you know, come up against these questions normally from sort of smarty pants media buyers who say, oh, well, you know, what is the future for, you know, a print brand like Monocle? Because, you know, is there really, you know, a business model? Because clearly everyone who's reading has to be sort of, you know, over 30 or 35. And we, you know, we say, no, the amazing thing is that, you know, we constantly get correspondence and meet people who, you know, someone is an 18-year-old political science student, or someone is, you know, a 21-year-old graphic designer, and they're obsessed with print. And I'm wondering, when you've sort of, having sort of run this business for a while, have you noticed a demographic shift and maybe even sort of a bigger flight on the part of a different type of consumer to print?
What we have noticed in our shops is a two-sided phenomenon. In our shops, you have one side of the shop that is dedicated to books and the other side that is dedicated to magazines. So the sales per title on the book side have dropped catastrophically. I suppose a lot of it due to the competition of Amazon, very simply. A lot of people just scan barcodes and go and order it straight on their iPhones and get it delivered at home. But I think a lot as well due to the fact that, say, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, actually, when we started Magma, if you wanted to know about the work of a photographer, you'd have no choice but to go to print. Mm. Now, you just Google the photographer's name, go to this website, and you have his whole output in there. So the way people use print has changed. However, there's the other side of the equation, the other wall at Magma, which is the magazines. And that wall has not stopped increasing in terms of sales. Actually, magazines seem to sell better now than they used to do, at least at our shops, 10 years ago. That may be to do with the fact that a lot of our competition has shut down. That may be part of it. But I don't think it's just that. I think magazines somehow still fulfill a role, which I'm puzzled by it myself, because already carrying just the few magazines that I brought to the program was really hard. And on my bicycle, it was really tough. But they still fulfill a role. And I would say with every new issue, just to get the example of Monocle sells more than, I would say, 90% of the books that are in the shop.
You can come on this program every single week.
Well, let's talk about some of those magazines that you've lugged here on your bike. Talk us through the one that's right in front of you at the moment.
Maybe we can start with Purple, which I think it's a really important magazine, not just for in terms of a magazine. It's an important magazine in terms of art, in terms of photography, in terms of fashion. It was born in the 90s, I think in 1992, and it really changed the way things looked. Suddenly, I mean, the grungy look that became like the staple of the 90s was really born out of that, with the photographers like Jürgen Teller that really became known through this magazine. And Purple really is this, I mean, it's this very strange thing, this open, it's what magazines do best, it's this open platform with a point of view. And it's a very, I wouldn't say grungy, but it's a very low-key thing. It's not glossy, though it has very glossy pages too. And I mean, the other thing that it had is very Parisian. It's very thoughtful. It really tries to analyze things in a very critical way.
Mm. Just in terms of its importance, what do you think, we know what it did, but what does it continue to do that that makes it relevant in a magazine landscape, do you think?
I think it's, I mean, I keep going back to it and thinking, oh, this issue, I'm really not going to like it. This issue really looks too fashion, or it looks too much this or too much that. And every time I'm surprised. For example, this issue has a very, I mean, I was really, I don't know if that ever happens to you, but I was green with envy because they did exactly what I wanted to do in one of our issues of Elephant.
But I think that's, but that's the exciting thing, isn't it, though? I mean, just that the bar, you know, continues to move upwards, and you see titles, you know, do either very simple things. I got Travel Almanac the other day.
Okay.
And the editor sent me, it was just a wonder. He sent it in a perfectly fitting box that it came in with these postcards, and I was just like, ugh.
That's something that.
Yeah, no, it was like we've been talking about it forever, and it's just we've never, you know, we haven't gotten around to it yet. And you just, but I love that. I think it's just, it's a great moment when you're, you know, working on, you know, your business and your title every day, and you see someone sort of pushing it out there further.
Yes, in this case, it was an interview with the painter David Sayle, who I think is, I mean, a great painter, but unfortunately gets associated with a certain type of big painting in the 80s, and he's still a fairly young painter and is still doing great work. And I always thought, wow, somebody really needs to do an in-depth interview and look at his work seriously. And that's just what they did. and they seem to manage to find a way of making everything extremely trendy and extremely contemporary. And yeah, there is something about it. The way they use paper is just insane. Yeah. I mean, they just seem to swap, I mean, to change papers in a way that must cost a fortune. I don't know how they afford it. They can afford it, but it's fantastic.
Yeah, but it's also interesting as well that we've noticed that the major paper mills, I think, you know, obviously they've seen their businesses challenged. I mean, you see, you know, no shortage of them, really flatlining in terms of their results. So I think a lot of the paper companies want to work with titles in a different way. So just a guess, but I would imagine that they're probably cutting some very good deals to become a portfolio.
Possibly, yes. But they, for example, have a first part that is all on this bluish, uncoated paper.
Mm.
And then suddenly, halfway through, they insert glossy pages to put their ads in. And I mean, that costs a fortune to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, another thing that makes us very, very envious. What do you have next?
I think after that, there's another magazine, which, again, is another... I mean, in a way, the other thing that Purple did is that I think it established this new format that is now extremely successful of the biannual magazine of, say, changing the idea, okay, that a fashion magazine before was a monthly thing that would keep up with trends. And then suddenly titles like Purple, like Self Service said, okay, we can go the next level, do a really huge magazine. And it comes out only twice a year, like the fashion shows, normally just before the fashion shows. And it had a whole series of magazines following that. So now you have Pop, you have Lula, you have a whole load of magazines like that. And another magazine is one of those. Possibly the one I usually like least and find it too controlled. I find it a bit contrived. I don't find it spontaneous enough. It's really the opposite of Self-Service. No, of Purple.
Purple, yeah.
But this issue has an amazing thing by Jeff Dyer, writer Jeff Dyer, and they've asked him to edit their literary pages at the end. And those are normally very, very good. And in this case, they're particularly good. He's done something on appropriation. So he basically rounded up a whole, some writers and some artists who are all talking about the theme of appropriation, which I think is really, really contemporary and is something that we all struggle to get our heads around in the internet age. And I think just those last few pages are worth it. As it happens, the rest of the magazine, it's one of those magazines that I keep wanting to dislike. And then when I look into it, I think, wow, this is really good. Even, you know, their roundup of handbags is really good. And I found myself, you know, just looking at these handbags and thinking, this is amazing. So so I actually think it's a really good issue, as it happens, and worth buying just for Jeff Dyer, actually.
Do you get a sense it's a magazine that's evolving over time, that's, you know, realizing that it does certain things well, but it can keep on changing?
I don't actually, to be perfectly honest. I think both Purple and Another have stuck to their format from the word go, which maybe is a good thing, maybe is a bad thing. I still don't know. Is it good to keep changing the structure of a magazine every issue, to keep bringing in new ideas? I'm not sure. I think, but they really have, you know, you look at, I mean, Purple actually has changed quite a bit from the 90s, but in the last 5-6 years, it hasn't.
It's been very consistent.
It's been very, consistent is a nicer way to put it.
You've got the new apartment over there.
Yeah.
That is the new one, isn't it? Yes. Yes.
Yeah. New one, I don't know, because at Magma we really struggle to get our heads around the
frequencies of some magazines.
Yeah, of this. People, I think it's among the most commonly asked questions, most frequently asked questions at Magma. When is the new Apartamento coming out? Mm. It comes out in, I think, in Barcelona, where it's edited mainly, though it mentions Milan as well.
Mm.
And I don't know if it comes on horseback to the UK, but it takes literally 2 months to travel from Barcelona to the UK.
Well, it probably is the staff filling up a couple of duffel bags, isn't it? And then the next time they've got a flight, then...
Who's off to London? Oh, okay, I'll take the bag, yeah.
I'm sure it must be by truck or bus, actually. Maybe 2 or 3 bus connections. Because it's, I mean, it's incredible. They announce it on their website. They offer it for sale on their website. And for 2 months, people say, it's on their website. The new issue's on their website. Website. When is it coming out?
Right.
So this is the latest.
It's worth it when it does show up.
It is worth it, actually.
That's why are people passionate about Apartamento? What do you think it is?
I think Apartamento completely changed how we think of interior design magazines. Mm. It just completely turned the format up, you know, the other way around and said, okay, normally people think of interior design magazines as glossy and big. We'll just do small and cute and uncoated and not glossy at all. And instead of looking at big interiors by great interior designers. No, we'll look at how people actually live. And you get a great sense of warmth from the pages. You know,
The little supplement that they did, this little sort of mini sort of food supplement. That's what's interesting as well. You really sort of see that they're pushing towards a food supplement quite soon, I think.
Yeah,
yes, I feel
orange. That's probably right, actually. But I like the attachment to how people actually live. Like, for example, there's one short feature by Mike Mayer, the German graphic designer, on his house in south of Mallorca and what he does there. And he basically says he goes there and he talks about his stereo system and the fact that he goes there and puts on Bob Dylan, and so there's a Bob Dylan song per day, and then he writes what he did that day, and it's just a little diary thing, and it takes about 4 or 6 pages, but it's incredibly nice and beautifully done, and I think he's taking a picture for every day, and they just do simple things really, really well. And
are there magazines that you sell that you love but for whatever reason you just can't shift? That you like every month, let's get it in again, this time it'll work, but they just don't go.
Yeah, that does happen, actually. In particular, I'd say where we struggle most is photography magazines. You'd think photography magazines are an easy sell, but they're not. They're usually expensive, and they're really hard to shift. People don't want to buy a magazine just for the quality of the visual work. I think people need, somehow, they need something like gossip, or they need commentary, they need diaries, they need they need to feel a human presence in a magazine. If they don't feel that, they don't buy it. And very often we have magazines that I think are very beautiful, you know, this is amazing. But if you don't have that human element, it doesn't sell.
Just before we go, the selection process, you know, obviously there are major fairs that you can go to. I mean, clearly you are, you know, a name internationally now. So do you have to go out and look, or pretty much everything shows up through your letterbox or in the form of an email, you know, when you look for titles?
We generally prefer to look at a physical copy of a magazine, because I think that's the problem with the internet. You don't get a sense of what the magazine is. You don't get that feel that you get from print, that real feeling of this is a statement, you know, in terms of editorial and design.
So you'd like to get a copy then, you know, through the post, and then say, okay, we're going to order 10 or 20 or 50 or whatever it may be.
And mostly, I mean, we don't go out to find magazines. We run away from them because we get bombarded with so many new magazines all the time. Mm. It's just incredible. I mean, people talk about the end of print, but certainly they haven't said that to the people who are creating new magazines.
That must be quite satisfying then, to know that you clearly are in the right business if, you know, if actually you're getting bombarded with new magazines all the time, that it's, you know, there are people out there who are doing new stuff every day.
There is, but I think there are worrying signs too. I think there's a serious problem in terms of distribution of magazines. There's no real good system, and I think magazine outlets are dying out there. So we may be the last ones left. As
yeah,
well. So
I mean, I always sort of think it'd be worth you guys going on the offensive. And when you leave the building, there's a couple of empty spaces on the street around here. I think it'd be great for you guys to move west. Would be a good idea. Mark, thank you very much for joining us from Magma Books. That Steve, that almost brings us to the end of the review here on this Saturday. Today's show is produced by Don Trump. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our sound engineer today is the lovely Mr. Alex Funnel Beyond the Glass. Over there.
He is indeed. You can catch the best of the week stories with Hugo MacDonald on the Curator even.
Glad he's not doing it live today, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. He recorded this yesterday, yeah. so it wasn't done with any sort of hangover. And of course, don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air tomorrow at 11 a.m. London time. That's going to be with me and Sophie Grove and Jonathan Openshaw.
Was it a jolly show?
It's a very jolly show. There's wine tasting. There's all sorts. There's also going to be some Oscars chat as well.
Excellent. Very good. Well, you've been listening through with me, Tyler Berlay, and Steve Bloomfield. Have a great weekend. News is next with the wonderful Mr. Nick Kelly. Goodbye.